is CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor. Here's John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor, and I welcome Tom Joslin, Senior Fellow for the Foundation for the Defense of Democracy. He and his colleague Bill Raggio and their colleagues keep the Long War Journal, which is a chronicle of the vast canvas of the jihadists, the Ummah, from the Atlantic Ocean to the Hindu Kush. We're concentrating on Afghanistan because of events in the news about the U.S. withdrawal and what is next. I start with a report from Kabul within these last hours, Reuters. 15 diplomatic missions and the NATO representative in Afghanistan urged the Taliban to halt their military offensives just hours after the rival Afghan sides failed to agree on a ceasefire at a peace meeting in Doha. A delegation of Afghan leaders met the Taliban's political leadership in the Qatari capital over the weekend. But the Taliban, in a statement late on Sunday, made no mention of a halt to Afghanistan's escalating violence. The quote here is from In Despair. The Eid al-Adha, the Taliban, this Eid al-Adha, a notable date in the Ummah calendar, the Taliban should lay down their weapons for good and show the world their commitment to the peace process. Tom, a very good morning to you. It is admirable that these representatives are calling for peace after the U.S. has ended its 20 years of commitment to seeking peace in Afghanistan. I mentioned these diplomats. At the same time, there is news that one man who is not especially diplomatic, that would be the all-powerful president of Turkey, Mr. Erdogan, has called the Taliban's offensive an occupation, has called for the Taliban to end its occupation of Afghanistan. Putting all these things together, it looks to me that we're moving at cross purposes. Your map, the map you and Bill and your colleagues have kept these many years, are facts on the ground. How does the map, and it's quite advanced from a week ago when we talked, how does that map respond, answer these diplomatics seeking a peace? Good morning to you.
Good morning, John. Well, you know, so far there really is no peace process, of course, in Doha. That's sort of a fiction that's been told time and time again by officials in Washington. The Taliban in the most recent round of just talks, I don't know how you would even describe them other than just talks, we're seeking a 3-month ceasefire, but in exchange for a 3-month ceasefire, they wanted two things. They wanted 7,000 of their prisoners released from Afghan detention facilities and prisons. Now, those 7,000 included, you know, hardened jihadist leaders, Al-Qaeda figures, probably even some Al-Qaeda external operations figures, we're told. These are jihadists that the Taliban wants released because, for an obvious reason, it gives them additional manpower in their conquest to try and take over the country. The second thing they wanted in exchange for this 3-month ceasefire was the delisting of all their leaders from the UN sanctions list. Now, why would they want that? Well, the main thing is that would allow them to travel with impunity for in the future here to raise monies and to raise funds for their Islamic Emirate that they're trying to resurrect. And it would allow them to go around the world about their business. And these sanctions do provide a roadblock against their fundraising efforts. So they want those two things, which would be a very big, tall order for the Afghan government and the U.S. to give them, very big concessions indeed for a short-lived 3-month ceasefire. Now, what you can see on the map is that there is no ceasefire, of course, inside Afghanistan. What the Taliban has done and Al-Qaeda, what Taliban and Al-Qaeda have done is they've taken the fight into a number of provincial capitals. There are battles raging in urban centers now in Afghanistan, including in Kandahar City, which is in a major hub in Afghanistan. So basically there is no ceasefire, and in exchange for a short-lived 3-month ceasefire, the Taliban wants basically the whole cake.
Yes, I'm looking at the map now, Tom, and everyone is encouraged to go to Long War Journal to see the map. It's a ring of fire around Kabul. This doesn't include the topography, knowing where the mountain ranges are, but Kabul itself is surrounded by peaks, by ridges, looking into this bowl of Kabul. And what the Taliban has very correctly discerned is that the Afghan National Army will not dispute the territory along the borders, so that the border with Iran, the border with Pakistan, the border all the way into as far north as Tajikistan is Taliban dominated or Taliban threatened. Only Kabul right now looks to be safe. I suppose some of those inner provinces around Kabul, you could say, are contested. But can we discern what the thinking is in Kabul on this, where the Afghan National Army is? They do have a lot of firepower.
Yeah, you know, our sources have said that the Afghan, the army and the security forces have been scrambling to get their act together to figure out what they're going to do. They are involved in heavy fighting. They have been pushing back. They've been suffering significant casualties while also delivering casualties to the Taliban and al-Qaeda. However, it's clear that the Taliban and al-Qaeda, the jihadis, have had the initiative in this war fighting since May 1st. You mentioned these points, these cross border crossings, really, and as you laid out, John, they are in the north on the border crossings with the stands, for example, Tajikistan. It's a very lucrative border crossing that generates quite a bit of revenue every day for the Afghan government, or it did until the Taliban took it over. And then you talk about the border crossing with Iran, which, of course, the Taliban has logistic and facilitation networks on the other side of the border with Iran. The Iranians have allowed the Taliban to do that for years. And then you talk about, you know, with the border with Pakistan, you know, Spin Baldak, which has been a key border crossing there, has been contested. The Afghans claim to have retaken it. The last reports I've seen are murky, but it seems that the Taliban is still in charge and has unfurled its Islamic banner at the border crossing. So basically, they've had the initiative. They've been dictating the pace of the fight. What we're trying to wait to see is if the Afghans can get their act together where they can start dictating the pace of the fight themselves and take back some of this lost ground and start delivering some significant strategic blows to the Taliban and al-Qaeda. So far, they haven't been able to do that.
This looks like siege mentality. So what is the supply line to Kabul? The last time I checked, it was overland through Pakistan. Is that supply line open? Is it threatened? Do we know?
I think a good number of the supply lines from every direction have been cut off now and are controlled by the jihadis. And it's absolutely a siege mentality. I mean, look, I mean, on the one hand, you could say they're laying siege to these locations and they haven't taken any provincial capitals yet, which is true. The jihadis have not captured any of the provincial capitals yet. So far, the Afghan forces have been able to hold on to those key areas. However, as you can see on the map, they've basically encircled all these urban, more urbanized areas, urban by Afghanistan standards, obviously, and are laying siege to them. And they're preparing to basically consolidate the control over the whole country. This is why this has always been a fiction about the peace process. As you can look at the map, there is no easy way to divide the country between these two forces. I mean, what you see is the Taliban and al-Qaeda have surrounded all of the provincial capitals in Kabul with the intent of taking them as soon as they can. Now, that's where the Afghans are putting up a fight. But there's no way to say, okay, well, the Taliban's just going to get these couple areas here, and then the Afghan government will take these areas over there. It just doesn't work that way. They're basically, the Taliban and al-Qaeda are trying to take the whole country.
Let us review where we've come from. In the springtime, the Taliban was nowhere near this dominant on the map. As I recall, it was about a third of the districts were either threatened or contested or under question. Now it's well over half. And what we're looking at is this advance. Your observation, there has been reporting that the Taliban has been surprised about how much success that it's had since the decision by the Biden administration to withdraw. Is that the driver for this advance? Did the Taliban noticeably accelerate after the Biden administration made its remarks, or did the Biden administration observe the inevitable and make that decision? Can we tell, Tom?
I don't think there's any doubt that what the Taliban and al-Qaeda have done here was they planned for this offensive to take place on May 1st of this year. The reason for that is because that was the date that was enshrined in the Trump administration's agreement with the Taliban, which all U.S. forces would be withdrawn. Of course, they weren't all withdrawn by then, but the U.S. committed to withdrawing them in short order. And that's what President Biden announced on April 14th. And so as soon as President Biden reaffirmed that the U.S. was getting out, albeit on a delayed schedule, they went forward with the offensive they had long planned. And why were they planning for May 1st? Well, because once the U.S. and NATO had removed its forces from the fight, that meant that the key special operations forces, key air assets would be out of the country and would no longer be used to stop the jihadis from taking over these districts and these key ground, this key ground. And so that's why they planned this in advance. And I do think that they're probably surprised by the speed of their success. And that's, by the way, is one of the reasons why they may want the 3 month ceasefires, because they want to consolidate the ground that they've captured, sort of reconfigure their war machine, get some concessions in the meantime, and then have the next and prepare for the next round of the fighting.
Right. It appears that they've gone so fast, they've got supply line problems as well to keep their troops fed and armed and on the move and in contact. Speaking to Tom Joslin, a senior fellow of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracy, he and Bill Raggio and their colleagues keep the Long War Journal. We've been looking at the map of the Long War Journal, but there are press reports from many capitals, and we're going to start with Moscow, about what is next. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Tom Joslin, senior fellow for the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. Along with his colleague Bill Raggio, they keep the Long War Journal, the chronicle of the vast canvas of the Ummah and the battle against the jihadists, chiefly al-Qaeda. And al-Qaeda is a major factor, but we begin with talk of the Taliban because of the U.S. withdrawal, which we believe is either 90% or 100%. The U.S. has committed itself to protecting embassies. However, other capitals have notions that are going in different directions. I go to Moscow, AP report in these last days. Moscow expects the Taliban to fulfill its pledge not to threaten Russia or its allies in Central Asia, the Kremlin envoy on Afghanistan said in an interview. Zamir Kabilov, who met with a Taliban delegation that visited Moscow last week, voiced confidence that the Taliban would focus on securing their gains in Afghanistan and wouldn't try to challenge the countries on the region. This delegation visited Moscow to offer guarantees on behalf of the Taliban's supreme leadership that the territory of Afghanistan will not be used against the interests of third countries, Kabilov said. The Taliban's focus on fighting the Islamic State group also works in Russia's interest, Kabilov said. Tom, we know that Russia has conducted a military exercise in Tajikistan in these last days. The number I had was 6,000 military personnel on the border of northern Afghanistan. But we also know that Russia is profoundly spooked by what's going on in Afghanistan, not the least because there are a lot of men, veterans, 50s and 60s and 70-year-olds, who have bad dreams to this day of their war in Afghanistan in the 1980s. And so they're looking at this map. But since then, of course, the Soviet Union has disappeared, and what we have are the stands. I visited the stands, Uzbekistan in particular, the large, richest, and most likely stand to join in prosperity in this century. And I know that the government there was depending upon Afghanistan to remain a bulwark against the jihadists, who have reason to believe that they can recruit widely in Uzbekistan, a large population, a young population that is secularized because of the century of Soviet occupation. Young people who are anxious, ambitious. In other words, exactly the right fertile ground for recruiting by the jihadists. So these protestations by the diplomat from Moscow that he's trusting that the Afghanistan Taliban will not attack the Central Asian states. Do we take him seriously? Is he being ambitious or utopian?
Well, I think at this point, the Taliban and its Central Asian allies, which are all allied with al-Qaeda, are concentrated on the war fighting in Afghanistan. They want to consolidate and win the Islamic Emirate. And there's a lot of work left to be done in that regard. It's not certain, of course, at this point that they're going to win outright, or how quickly they're going to win. Let's put it that way. The Afghan forces are putting up a fight in different areas. They're holding them at bay, but it doesn't look good for the Afghan forces either. So the point is that the jihadis want to consolidate their control. They want to consolidate the Islamic Emirate in Afghanistan. That's the first task. Shy of that, I don't think that they're going to make any major push into the Central Asian states at this point. That could change at any time once they feel like it's time to have a go of it. And the point is that they have jihadis from Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, Turkmenistan, the different Central Asian states that are fighting in the Taliban offensive in northern Afghanistan. They've been key to actually the Taliban's gains in northern Afghanistan. I think that it remains to be seen that, what these Central Asian jihadis are going to do. But of course, some of them we know via ISIS and via other groups are definitely looking to commit terrorist attacks in their home countries. So I think it's only a matter of time till we see an uptick in those types of terrorist attempts anyway. But I don't think right now that's their main focus.
Another capital of great alarm. This is the Times of India, New Delhi Dateline. With the Taliban being joined by Pakistanis in Afghanistan in large numbers, their fighters have been instructed by the Inter-Services Intelligence, the infamous ISI, to target the Indian-built assets in the war-torn country. The Indian government has invested over $3 billion in the Afghanistan reconstruction effort since the last two decades. Tom, your page and your colleagues have covered over the years the threat of the jihadists to India. I would say that this matter is understated in this presentation because we know from your reporting over the years, the Taliban of Afghanistan is intimately integrated with the Pakistan Taliban, and all are committed to undermining the Pakistani government. In addition, they're easily recruited to attack the Indian facilities in the coming days. So do you take India's alarm here significant? Is it significant? And is there an option for India other than just withstanding these attacks?
Well, I think the Indian government has good reasons to be alarmed or have significant concerns about what's going on here. There are multiple ways this could play out. I mean, remember, John, first of all, the Haqqani network, which is a key part of the Taliban and is also closely allied with Al-Qaeda, really helped build Al-Qaeda, has already gone after the Indian embassy and Indian assets in Afghanistan on multiple occasions. We know that the jihadis going back to the 1990s were, hijacking Indian aircraft and were plotting to, do prisoner swaps, and that there have been multiple plots inside India itself through the years. An additional dynamic here to keep a lookout for is that the disputed territories in Jammu and Kashmir contain a small Al-Qaeda affiliated group that has been implicated in recent weeks in a terrorist plot inside India itself. And the commander of that operation has been identified as a guy known as Umar al-Helmandi. Now, Helmandi, John, you'll recognize that as a nom de guerre that references his presence or his life or his background in Helmand, the southern province of one of the southern provinces of Afghanistan. And we know that Kashmiri fighters have been taking part in the war on behalf of the Taliban against the Afghan government as well. So there is an angle there to be concerned about if you are the Indians. There's no doubt that Al-Qaeda has had a role in plots against India in the past, and no doubt that they have an eye at doing more attacks in the future.
I'm speaking with Tom Jossen of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracy. We're ranging through the capitals. Quickly, Tom, I mentioned that China is also citing that there are grave concerns of what happens with the U.S. withdrawal. This is the South China Morning Post, just a couple of paragraphs. The withdrawal of American troops from Afghanistan has allowed the Taliban to capture large swaths of territory in the northern part of the country. With the United States saying its withdrawal is 95% complete, the Taliban has forced more than 2,000 Afghan security forces into Tajikistan. The headline for this is U.S. troop exodus from Afghanistan leaves Russia, China worried about extremists. So Russia to the north, China to the east, India to the south, three large, extremely geopolitical powerhouses in the 21st century, all sending up smoke signals that this is trouble. When we come back, Al-Qaeda. Tom Jossen, Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. I'm John Batchelor.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor, and I'm visiting with Tom Jossen of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies, a senior fellow. He and Bill Raggio and their colleagues keep the Long War Journal, which is a chronicle of the vast canvas of the Umad, where the jihadists range and recruit and are successful, especially no more so than in Afghanistan. We're observing what now for Afghanistan, but for the region, Eurasia. We can cite Moscow and Beijing and Delhi, all gravely concerned. Let's throw in, not throw in, let's mention Islamabad, which is compromised because its state security has used the Taliban and its recruiting power over the years to turn those suicide killers against India, against its neighbor and perpetual rival, India in the subcontinent. But now we turn to the much darker story to tell and harder to see, Al-Qaeda. Tom, you and Bill and your colleagues over the years have made it very clear that Al-Qaeda never departed from Afghanistan, that all of the Taliban successes are integrated into the Al-Qaeda network, Al-Qaeda command, the resources, the recruiting. You mentioned just as a matter of fact how much of the Taliban is recruited from the stands and from other parts of the world. This is an international organization. Al-Qaeda makes that all possible because of its theology. You have a new piece about Al-Qaeda and its ability to threaten and project power, and not only in the region, but outside the region. And what we're looking at here is not just Al-Qaeda, but also Iran. This is where you need a scorecard, which is why you need the Longwire Journal. John has mentioned Russia, Tajikistan, China, Pakistan, India. Now we're plunging into Iran. What is the benefit to Iran to assist Al-Qaeda? And what does it look like now, Tom, your new piece at the Dispatch?
Well, John, the piece of the Dispatch that I wrote deals with last week, federal prosecutors revealed that there was this kidnapping plot that was targeting Masih Ahmadinejad, who is a very colorful and intelligent human rights activist who's long opposed to the Iranian regime. That's the regime that controls her native country. And she's done so at great personal risk. Her family in Iran has been harassed and imprisoned by the Iranian intelligence and Iranian security forces. There's been threats against her and her life. And she's a very, brave advocate against the Iranian regime. Well, it turns out that in the Iranian regime has been trying to basically net her since 2018. They first went to her family in an attempt to pay her family to lure her to a third country where she would be kidnapped and then deported to Iran. Then that didn't work because her family remained steadfast. So in 2020, they came up with this idea that they were going to use networks inside the U.S. to first spy on her in her home in Brooklyn using high definition cameras and other high tech equipment. And they were going to spy on her and eventually hope that they were going to kidnap her and abscond with her either to Venezuela or somewhere else and then ultimately on to Iran where she would have been imprisoned and likely killed. The FBI and American officials got wind of this plot and they were able to help her thwart it and they were able to protect her and protect her family. But it shows that the Iranians who continue with this plot all the way to this year in 2021 were deadly serious about trying to use their networks inside the U.S., inside New York City, to come get her and to take her out of the country, which would have been quite the spectacle, of course, and horrific. Well, in the piece I wrote about this Ministry of Intelligence and Security for Iran, which is the main intelligence arm of the Iranian regime, and in addition to hunting Iranian dissidents, which is one of their specialties, they also harbor and have provided travel facilitation for Al-Qaeda. And this is something that was revealed during the Obama administration in a designation by the U.S. Treasury Department in 2012, where they described the evidence that the U.S. government has accumulated against the MOIS, that's the Ministry of Intelligence and Security, and they described how at times this Iranian intelligence arm would provide passports and facilitate the movements of Al-Qaeda around the globe. And so what I wanted to do was highlight or juxtapose these two things. On the one hand, the Iranian intelligence is trying to hunt down someone who's advocating for freedom and advocating on behalf of human rights like Masih Ahmadinejad, while on the other hand is harboring and facilitating the movements of terrorists like Al-Qaeda.
All right, Tom, now I want to put these puzzles together. Al-Qaeda is intimately involved in the Taliban's successes. Afghanistan borders Iran. Do we have an understanding of how Iran's state security has used Al-Qaeda, has used the Taliban's offensive, has used this integration over these years, not just now, but since the turn of the century, 20 years. Is there a clear chain of command, or are these all opportunities that spring up and they're operations that are separate from a working together?
You know, they're not wholly separate. There is overlap here. One of the things that was revealed in this series of designations that have been put out by the U.S. Treasury Department and the State Department is that The Iranian government allows al-Qaeda to maintain its core facilitation pipeline. That was a phrase that became popular during the Obama years inside Iran. And what this core facilitation pipeline does is, on the one hand, it moves messages and money and fighters out of South Asia, out of Afghanistan and Pakistan to other places, but also moves those same things, money, communications and fighters, into South Asia. And so this facilitation pipeline has been essential for al-Qaeda in terms of managing its affairs globally. And a part of that story is, of course, the war fighting in Afghanistan. So this facilitation hub that the Iranians allow al-Qaeda to maintain has been essential for al-Qaeda to maintain its role in the war in Afghanistan while also directing plots and war fighting elsewhere.
Let's go back to India. This is another headline within these last days from the India Blooms website. Experts believe al-Qaeda may make swift return to Afghanistan as Taliban surges ahead. The imminent fall of Afghanistan is more than a national disaster, writes the editorialist. It is not just that the gains made in the past two decades at the cost of tens of thousands of lives and trillions of dollars look certain to be reversed. The Taliban's victory is also an al-Qaeda victory, and it has global implications. I believe your page would embrace that opinion, but again, India is alarmed, Tom, and they're alarmed because I have to believe that they're knowledgeable that al-Qaeda never left Afghanistan, never left Pakistan, and is part of the threat tool for their rivals in Pakistan. So just as it's murky to say how Iran works with Taliban and al-Qaeda, is it also murky to say how Pakistan works with al-Qaeda and the Taliban, or is that a more clear command structure?
Well, it's clear that al-Qaeda never left Afghanistan, as you tease there, John. I do think you're going to see foreign fighters from al-Qaeda and others who have been dispatched around the globe and operating elsewhere probably will make their way back to Afghanistan in the coming weeks and months if they haven't already. I think we've already seen some indications of that from Syria and elsewhere. However, al-Qaeda always maintained its networks and its prominent role in the war fighting underneath the Taliban's banner in Afghanistan. This is one of the main things the U.S. got wrong, was an understanding of what al-Qaeda was actually doing in Afghanistan. When it comes to Pakistan, what they've done is, I describe it as a wheel of jihad, John. And so think about this wheel as on the top part of it, you have the Inter-Services Intelligence Directorate of the Pakistani military, which is the main military intelligence arm of Pakistan. They've been deeply in bed with the Afghan Taliban and the Haqqanis, who are in turn deeply in bed with al-Qaeda and the Pakistani Taliban, which comes back to attack the Pakistani state. And so this is one of the areas where it's very intriguing to watch in the months to come if perhaps Pakistan has miscalculated here to some extent, because the same jihadis that they are supporting in Afghanistan against the Afghan government are deeply in bed with jihadis who are actually targeting the Pakistani state itself.
The concern then in India is not just about the Taliban, it's al-Qaeda. Very early on in the war, 20 years ago, al-Qaeda launched an attack on the India Congress. We all remember it vividly, so does India. Do we expect India to have an ability to be proactive with the return of the al-Qaeda networks in Pakistan and Afghanistan? Are we going to look at an increase of border conflict? Do we have any opinion at this point of how al-Qaeda is going to take this victory and go forward with it?
Well, in terms of al-Qaeda, we already know they've positioned their literature in Urdu and other regional languages, basically to have a focus on India and the Indian subcontinent. We've been watching that for now over a year, where they've already been telegraphing the fact that they're going to do more in India and elsewhere. Now, of course, you mentioned the attack on the Indian parliament in December of 2001. There are some indications that al-Qaeda actually had a heavy hand in that, and that was intended to just basically distract Pakistan and distract the U.S. And India from the flight of al-Qaeda members, including bin Laden, out of the Tora Bora Mountains. There's some evidence along those lines, although it's not at all clear. Then, of course, there's some evidence and some reporting that Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda had a hand in the Mumbai attacks in November 2008, which was the siege. John, this is one of the types of attacks that I tell people I'd be most concerned about being replicated in New York City or elsewhere, because it is fairly easy to replicate. It's something that the main guy who did the surveillance for it, David Headley, an American, actually was also reporting to Osama bin Laden through the chain of command, and some of his surveillance reports and other intelligence he accumulated ended up in bin Laden's compound. So this is one of those things where Al-Qaeda had a hand, we suspect, in the Mumbai attacks in November 2008, and probably had a hand in this December 2001 plot. It probably had a hand in other hijacking plots going back to the 1990s and other operations. I don't think there's any doubt that they're going to have a go of it here in India in the future. In fact, as I mentioned earlier, over the last week, there's been some reporting that this Al-Qaeda-affiliated outfit in Kashmir has been plotting suicide bombings in India, and that the Indian police and security forces just swept up a cell that was responsible for executing that plot.
ISIS. It's not finally ISIS. It's just that I have little information about ISIS because it's been operating in this region for some time, for some years. However, we're told that ISIS and Al-Qaeda are at loggerheads, not working together. We're told that ISIS does not work with the Taliban. Do we have any clarity, Tom, now that the U.S. is withdrawn? Is ISIS a power or is it a boutique?
Well, you know, most of our attention is focused on the Al-Qaeda-Taliban nexus because they're the ones who are really threatening the Afghan state and threatening to take over much, if not all, the country. But ISIS still has a prolific terrorist outfit, I would say. So this is something ISIS has already demonstrated has a capability of operating in Pakistan, a capability of operating in Afghanistan, Tajikistan, and they've been trying to carve out their own, and they have carved out their own cadre of Central Asian jihadists themselves that they want to use and repurpose for plots elsewhere. So ISIS is definitely part of the story and will remain part of the story. It's going to be interesting to watch how Taliban and Al-Qaeda react to ISIS's presence in Afghanistan in the future. One of the things that ISIS ran into was that the Taliban and Al-Qaeda actually limited their growth in Afghanistan by delivering them blows in eastern Afghanistan. And so that's one of the things we've been watching very carefully.
So right now we should conclude that ISIS is still at odds with Al-Qaeda. Is that correct? They're not working together in Afghanistan.
They're not working together. There's one caveat. The UN and there's some other reporting, not confirmed, that suggests that maybe the Haqqanis, who again are this key bridge between Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, they really exist in all these different organizations. The Haqqanis may have used ISIS or facilitated ISIS cells in executing attacks on civilians in Kabul and elsewhere that they didn't want to take credit for. They didn't want to take responsibility for. And there may be some sort of backdoor facilitation along those lines. That isn't proven, however, but you know, something to watch out for, and it's certainly possible anyway.
I'm speaking with Tom Jostlin, a senior fellow of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracy. He and his colleagues, Bill Rajo and others, keep the Long War Journal, the chronicle, the diary of the contest with the Ummah these last decades. Right now we're concentrating on Afghanistan. When we come back, we need clarity about whether or not the Taliban is going to permit the Al-Qaeda to operate at will in Afghanistan one more time. You will recall that was the original driver for the U.S. getting involved, was to seek Al-Qaeda. There are contradictory reports around the world. It needs clarity all the time. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with Tom Jostlin, a senior fellow of the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. He and his colleagues keep the Long War Journal, which is a chronicle of the battle against the jihadists, in particular the base, Al-Qaeda, these last decades. And I go to a headline in China. This is influenced by the Chinese Communist Party. It's the South China Morning Post, but it's in English in Asia, and so it has a dominant distribution. And it's important to have this headline as representative of other headlines that say the same thing, and it's confusing about where we are in the contest with Al-Qaeda. The headline, Al-Qaeda mocks U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan as Taliban continues its to advance. Subhead, following the exit of U.S. troops, the Taliban says it will not allow Al-Qaeda to operate in the country. But analysts say this is not the case. The Taliban is changing its public image, the subhead goes on to say, to improve its legitimacy and is making overtures to China to attract more investment to Afghanistan. You see the confusion, Tom, but analysts say this is not the case. You're one of those major analysts saying it's not the case. I won't ask for the politics of this, but is it your measure that this story that the Taliban will not permit Al-Qaeda to return is widespread? Is this something that's maintained in all of these capitals? Is this something that's in dispute, that Taliban is blocking Al-Qaeda?
You know, John, I just think there's widespread ignorance on this. I mean, Al-Qaeda's already there. They're already fighting on behalf of the Taliban to resurrect the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan. It's not a question of whether Al-Qaeda is in Afghanistan. It's not a question of them returning to Afghanistan. They're already there. They're already fighting. And in fact, the Taliban is very good at doublespeak in this regard, because if you can, the Afghan news outlet Tolo News recently published an interview with Zabihullah Mujahid, who is the name given to the Taliban spokesman or number of spokesmen operating under that nom de guerre. And there's all sorts of doublespeak in that. Like, this spokesman wouldn't even say anything about Al-Qaeda or preventing Al-Qaeda from operating in Afghanistan or preventing Al-Qaeda from working alongside the Taliban. He just denied that the Taliban even agreed to any of that. What he reiterated, which has been the long-standing Taliban claim since the 1990s, when they were clearly lying, and they've been clearly lying ever since, is that they wouldn't allow Afghan soil to be used for plotting attacks against other countries. The problem is that Afghan soil is being used to plot attacks against other countries right now. So this doesn't really make any sense. I mean, you can look at the cross-border activities in Pakistan, for example, or some of what's happened in Central Asia, or what we're seeing, the story unfolding throughout the Indian subcontinent. The truth of the matter is that all this conversation has been framed around a pre-9/11 mindset, where at the time, Al-Qaeda needed Afghanistan to train for the 9/11 hijackings. This is one of the big myths that's been rewritten by Taliban apologists, is that Afghanistan wasn't central to the 9/11 plot. It certainly was. All 19 hijackers were trained in Afghanistan. The plot was really came to fruition there. There's so many details I could give you about it, but it certainly was. It is not the case that that if Al-Qaeda wanted to do something like that again today, that they would need Afghan soil to train jihadis. They can train elsewhere, if that's true, but they could also train in Afghanistan. I mean, it's not an either or. They could train in, you know, I mean, I'm sorry, there's not a choice here where they can only do one. They could do both. They could actually train in places in Africa. They could train in Syria. They could train in Yemen. They could train in Afghanistan. So the bottom line is that Afghanistan is part of the jihadi war against the Crusader West, is what they describe it as. And it will continue to be so. But that doesn't mean Al-Qaeda necessarily needs Afghan soil to launch a 9/11 style plot, if that makes sense.
The politics of this are complicated, and I can't get too far into the politics because there are all these confusing voices. I will summarize that General Petraeus, who for a time was in charge of the Afghanistan conflict during the Obama administration, and President George W. Bush have both said in these last days that they expect this to go very badly after the U.S. withdrawal. President Bush has concentrated on what will happen to the women of Afghanistan. The horrors from the Taliban's Islamic Republic are still very well known and very well documented. General Petraeus is commenting on how the Taliban is an offensive power in the region. Neither are dealing especially with what we have just been discussing, Al-Qaeda. So I want to ask you in summary, Tom, we have a couple of minutes. Is Al-Qaeda stronger now because of the Afghanistan victory by the Taliban? Does this make Al-Qaeda's recruiting, Al-Qaeda's fundraising more effective?
Yeah, I think a victory for the Taliban in Afghanistan is a victory for Al-Qaeda. I think there's a lot of evidence along those lines. In fact, Al-Qaeda already declared victory in the war against the U.S. once the U.S. agreed to leave and withdraw from Afghanistan and said that they had defeated now this second superpower on Afghan soil. I think part of the story going on here, I think part of what we've warned about is we could see this becoming a boon for the jihadis' cause. Just as the victory over the Soviet Union the first time around was a boon for the jihadi cause, then, yeah, 9/11 became a major turning point for the jihadi cause, and certainly some attacks even before that, including the USS Cole bombing, proved to swell their ranks and led to a lot of recruitment. I think that this war now in Afghanistan and the U.S. retreat from Afghan soil and the Taliban and Al-Qaeda's advances and ISIS's lingering presence, I think all these things will mean this is going to continue to be part of the jihadi story going forward, and I think you could definitely see Afghanistan becoming a major destination for foreign fighters once again.
Tom Jocelyn, he is a senior fellow at the Foundation for the Defense of Democracies. He and Bill Raggio and their colleagues keep the Long War Journal. The map of the Long War Journal tells the tale in one glance. However, when you read into the documents that Tom and Bill and their colleagues have assembled over the years, you see that this was never a difficult story to solve. the Taliban and Al-Qaeda working together, continuing the pressure on the central government, continuing the pressure on the ability of Afghanistan to defend itself. And now, this is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.